Hello and welcome to the New Art of the Cut podcast, brought to you in partnership with Frame.io. My name is Steve Hallfish. I'm a feature film and documentary editor. For more than 7 years, over 300 interviews, I've been speaking to my colleagues in film, TV, and docs about the art and craft of editing. Today, we're speaking with Tom Cross, ACE, and Elliot Graham, ACE, about the latest James Bond epic and the final film of the Daniel Craig era, No Time to Die. We spoke via Zoom with Tom in LA and Elliot in London. I just missed talking to Elliot on a previous Art of the Cut when I spoke to his co-editors on Molly's Game, for which he was nominated for an Ace Eddie. And he was nominated for an Oscar and an Ace Eddie for his editing on Milk. In addition to those films, he cut Captain Marvel, Steve Jobs, The Amazing Spider-Man 2, Superman Returns, and X2, X-Men United, among others. He also cut the pilot for the TV series House. And congratulations to Tom Cross, who receives his Art of the Cut frequent flyer card today with his fifth interview. Previously, we spoke about Joy, Hostiles, La La Land, and First Man. Tom was, of course, nominated for a BAFTA and Ace Eddie and won the Oscar for Best Achievement in Film Editing for Whiplash, was nominated for an Ace Eddie for Joy, was nominated for a BAFTA and an Oscar, and won an Ace Eddie for La La Land, and he was also nominated for a BAFTA and an Ace Eddie for First Man. After we finish chatting with Tom and Elliot, we'll continue discussing the movie with their two assistant editors, Elise Anderson and Martin Corbett. Both are very familiar with work on big-budget titles. Elise's credits include Alien Covenant, Fantastic Beasts, and the upcoming Ant-Man and the Wasp movie, Quantumania. And Martin has worked on Star Wars Episode 7, Edge of Tomorrow, and Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, among others. If you're interested in reading this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to blog.frame.io, where there's a ton of great expert content for film professionals of all types. To our two editors today, my first question is, have they ever worked with this director before? First up with the answer to this question is Elliot Graham. Tom Cross answers next.
I worked with Carrie twice before, one on a commercial in 2009, which was both of our first commercial. I had just done Milk and he just done Sin Hombre, and they wanted sort of a naturalistic approach to the rebranding Levi's at White and Kennedy. And so that was an interesting experience. And then we did Beasts of No Nation together. I'm not credited on it. That was a bizarre choice of mine. I did all production in Africa. My back had gone out twice before on the previous film. It went out again in Africa. So I finished all of Africa, but I had to pass it on to someone else. And I just felt so terrible. I'd never left the film before that I said, give credit to whoever comes on. But we did all production in Africa together and then Bond.
And it was the first time I worked with Carrie. I had met Carrie before at a small screening of the movie Hostiles, a Scott Cooper Western that I worked on. And there were a couple of directors who Scott and producer John Lesher brought by to give some feedback, and Carrie was one of them. So I had met him before, but I had not worked with him.
How did he like to work with you guys as collaborators, since there were two of you?
Well, in production and post, it was two different things. In post, he had time to spend time in each of our rooms. Spend time as necessary working on scenes and hop back and forth. In production, he was more focused on set. We'd send him clips or show him clips in person. But we sort of worked as a team.
During shooting, it was a different situation. Elliot and I took scenes as they came in. Whoever was less busy, we took stuff and juggled things that way. We'd bring cuts on a laptop to set because our cutting rooms were at Pinewood Studios, which is where most of the film was shot, or a lot of the film was shot. And then once shooting wrapped, you know, Carrie was kind of situated with us, and he would kind of go from room to room, checkerboarding, giving us notes and us doing different things.
What about the collaboration between the two of you?
Ellie and I always found that aesthetically, our styles were very closely matched. We would show each other cuts, especially because I hadn't worked with Carrie before. I remember, you know, really wanting that support and help before I started showing rough cuts to Carrie. I would always run them by Elliot. And that was amazing to be able to have that resource.
It's such a joy to have a collaborator if you guys can communicate. And it's not that it's less work, it's that you can spend more time on the details. That's a joy. Because, you know, production's always this race. Do you want the best scene, or do you want to stay up to camera? Or do you want to have two editors and try and do both? It's fun to work on drama. It's fun to work on action. It's fun to bring them together. It's fun to do it with somebody else who does that.
And again, you know, we both did a little bit of everything. We both did action things. We both did serious performance drama things. We both basically had a sampling of everything that you see in the movie. What's amazing is I always knew that if I was cutting a fight scene or something like that, I wanted to show it to Elliot because I knew that with his amazing work, he had done things like that. And likewise, if I was cutting a simple dialogue scene, I would also want to run it by Elliot because his work contains beautiful, beautifully cut performances.
Being very nice. It went both ways, and that was the joy in it. Thank you, Tom. But it went both ways. And it was a conversation we had early on, which was like, let's just share our shit. Like, it's one voice, ultimately. If you want to be honest, ultimately, it's Carrie's voice. The reason I think in part we were hired is because we have eclectic resumes and because Carrie's work is eclectic, as is the movie.
Talk to me a little bit about that sense of knowing a director more than just knowing what the footage is saying to you.
Well, so Carrie's always focused on story and character, period. Kinetic energy, he knows how to do. All of that stuff he knows how to do. It's easy for him. Visuals are just a gift he's born with. And storytelling, but that's where he's focused, the story and the character. Our first project was a Levi's commercial in which there were basically 6 or 7 stories to fit into 1 minute, 30 seconds. He couldn't do it. But we really cut the 2 minute version first to go, what is the emotion? It doesn't matter if it's a commercial, what's the emotion? And then figure out what to sacrifice. Showing Carrie things is, yeah, he likes to see different versions so that he can see what the film could be. It's like great directors don't want to just see what is planned, although he certainly plans. They want to see all the possibilities and then figure out what it is.
Did you guys do that often, cut multiple versions of a scene?
We did do multiple versions of scenes, and we did that right from the beginning. And for me, not having worked with Carrie before, that was a little bit of a new process. And at first, it felt like it was counterintuitive because as an editor, I'm so used to making my first impression choices and then trying to stick to them. You know, this is what I think. This is what I reacted to. This is the lane that I'm going to go down. However, Carrie really pushed us to show different versions, not just a different, you know, not just the same scene with the ending that's different. He said, I want to see big alternates. And it forced us to, and forced me to almost like drop my preconceived notions about what I think the scene should be and just try something completely different, try a different approach. You know, for a simple thing would be, you know, I think it's more powerful to play this dialogue scene from the frontal singles. I think the performances, the way we see the faces, the eyes, that's my first gut impression. However, I'm going to do this other version where I'm going to use this other coverage that is only profile, which is a more graphic thing, less about looking directly into the eyes. And it might not be the first thing that I think about, but once I do that other version, I start seeing things that I didn't notice before. And that's a big part of this collaboration with Carrie, is he wants that feeling. He wants to kick the tires on all the scenes, and he wants to see what's possible. He wants to get a feeling for the outer edges of the coverage and what the choices are. And you never arrive at, oh, this version is the best one. It's always a hybrid of certain things. But by the end of it, I actually found it a really fruitful, interesting process. And it's one I actually have taken with me into projects since then, where I've just thought, you know what, here's my first cut of it, but let me just try to like pretend that isn't applicable. Pretend that I can't submit that cut. How can I cut something with the dailies that remain and try something there? And your brain is always progressing. It's always still evolving as you're cutting with the different coverage. What I found is that often it sheds light on things that I wouldn't have thought about before.
Carrie's a man of few words. And like I've said to Tom before, he's got 17 paragraphs of genius in his head, but he's not going to give them all to you, which is either a gift or frustrating, but it's a gift because go do your thing. He'll get to the 17 paragraphs. Well, that means there's lots of opportunity. I like opportunity. I started doing this thing a couple of years ago. I sort of learned from another director, but after I finished the scene, everybody's approved on. Everybody likes it, so it's a bit dangerous. Covering up the monitor, just looking at the timeline, you can toggle between different angles. I would just toss in other angles that I'd like that hadn't been used in the scene randomly. You don't know where you're dropping them because you're just looking at a timeline, not a screen. Dropping in different music and then watching it. It's completely incoherent. But when people talk about how do you create happy accidents, and that was my version of trying to figure out what outside the box is, create a little chaos. And what you find is mostly it's just chaos, but every now and then there's something nobody ever would have thought of.
When I think about presenting a first cut, a first rough cut to a director, especially one you haven't worked with before, I think of something that's very stressful, you know, because you're pitching something. You want it to go over well. You want to know that your first gut was right or that you're on the right track. And at worst, you don't want to make a pitch and then have it be rejected and then you get fired or something like that. Someone loses faith in you. But I think what was great about the way Carrie liked to work with us is that by pushing us to do these alternates, it took the preciousness out of that first cut. And by default, it basically was sending a message to us that said, take a swing. I don't care if you strike out or you hit it out of the park. You know, you're going to do neither with this, with these early cuts. He gave us license to take swings. And that's something that's really valuable.
Did you guys have to deal with a lot of stunt viz or pre-viz? Were you on before the movie at all?
Well, we were consulted early on. And I remember there was plenty of pre-viz and there was stunt viz. There were both of those things during production, in the middle of production, because there was a lot of stuff that was still evolving script-wise and visually. And a lot of that had to do with schedule being juggled around and reshuffled. A lot of that had to do with Daniel Craig's ankle injury. Which meant that Carrie could not shoot certain sequences the way he originally planned. Like in the case of the big Cuba action sequence, he had originally planned it to be a kind of a one-er, some form of a one-er, you know, because of his ankle and recovery time. They had to shuffle things around and start shooting other things first. And in some cases, shoot second unit action first on the Cuba set at Pinewood. And that necessitated a different architecture cinematically for that action sequence. It meant that some material, second unit, was shot first, and that there were sequences that could be built with those pieces, but then the rest had to be filled out with pre-viz, post-viz, and stunt viz, and that was an ongoing process for months. So it wasn't just in pre-pro, we had all that stuff during.
Included some of our assistant editors and us going up and being a stuntman with our brilliant French badass ex-special ops stunt supervisor. That was fun. But also challenging and fun.
Wait, you guys got to do stunts?
We had a couple assistant editors. The Cuba sequence, which was shot because of the injury, Danny was shot at one time, and Darmus was shot another time. The villains were shot another time. And then we came back to wrap them all up in a package. We would go up with an assistant editor and an iPhone and some of his stuntmen and go, okay, well, it could be this shot. All right, let's try that. We're not jumping off the sides of buildings, but we're trying to provide Carrie with a template of could be this, could be this, could be this as the connective tissue so that he could present Daniel, who gives everything to every moment, therefore limit what you give so that he doesn't break himself. You need him to be able to give everything because he gives everything. We need to know what we were shooting. Carrie needs to know what he was shooting at. He's always going to wing it, make it his own. But that was our job, to build creative, you know, connective tissue. And it was fun. That's one of the fun things about editing people don't understand, is it's not just alone in a room with a computer. You get to work with all these people, and that's the fun of it.
Absolutely. Did you even try to edit stuff when you were getting things so piecemeal on that?
Every single piece you have, right, Tom?
Yeah, you had to, because there were often questions about, okay, what have you got so far? Because we need to know what we need to get. And that's also a hallmark of Bond movies, has been a hallmark of Bond movies since the early days, multiple units shooting stunts, shooting action, shooting establishing shots all around the world. You know, that's the only way that these large movies can get done, is constantly moving and constantly gathering footage.
Love it or you hate it, you got to embrace it, but it can be a joy, right? It's an amusement park ride. Like, are we going to stay on board? Yeah, we are. We're always going to stay on board. It's fun.
And in some cases, we would get the video tap to cut. And so it was all about getting fast results. So I remember getting some stuff in, you know, for Matera, Italy, for example, where we would get the video tap footage in first, which always looks awful. It looks terrible. But we would try to cut the sequence with that. And sometimes we would show rough cuts. Often we would show stuff to carry, like video tap silent, just to give him an idea of the pieces. We put little placeholders where stuff was. If there was an existing animatic, we'd have whatever little holes were there, we would fill out with animatics or boards. And it was all about just trying to like present a map that would constantly be and quickly be updated as they shot more material.
Different editors have different perspectives. There's no right or wrong. It's just your own personal personality. Do I hate production? No, I love that. I much more enjoy post-production, because there is simply the race between quality and staying up to the camera. And you can't have both 100%. it's not possible. I enjoy post more only in that I get to work on the perfectionist side of things, right, Tom? But in production, you have to embrace a different rush. You just have to. You're not going to make the best edits possible. You do what you can because your ultimate job is to make sure you're getting the material you need.
Agreed. And you know, there's so many, we're all editors. So we know that there are how many thousands of decisions that have to be made. And you're going to, you know, your batting average, even when it's good, means that you're going to be making tons of decisions that you're going to have to change later. And, you know, by later, I mean after shooting stops and the director can come in and work with you. I actually get worried when that happens less. And most of the time that doesn't happen. Things do change, but I want it to change because the joy of this for me is collaborating. And so I don't want to be left with my first rough cut. I want Elliot to kick the tires on it. I want Carrie to kick the tires on it. Let's break it apart to make it even better than we all envisioned.
Well, talk to me about that move from cutting during dailies to cutting post your first assembly where you're actually working with the director and you are now seeing the context of what you've done.
I always feel like if you're lucky working on a film, you know, you're lucky if you have a film that has amazing set pieces that you really love, great scenes, you know, whether action or dramatic that you really love. And the goal is to try to get to those scenes as quickly as possible. What are those bumps in the movie? Where are they? Where are those important bumps? And how can we get to them in an efficient manner?
What was one of the big points that you're trying to get to in this movie? What were you trying to get to? Like, we need to get to this moment sooner.
I think we had different milestones along the way. Our challenge started at the very beginning because every Bond movie is big. Every Bond movie is epic. What's different about this movie is it is epic in the same way, but then also we have an added aspect of time. We're telling a story that's epic in time. Not just visually, not just cinematically, but it's a Bond story with three time periods, and that hasn't been done before. We always knew out of the gate that the pre-title teaser was going to be longer than previous Bond movies. And in fact, it is the longest teaser in Bond history. And we always knew that from the script because of the story that had to be told. We had to start with Madeline as a young girl, and then we had to go to Bond and Madeline just after Spectre, the movie ends, and pick up where we left off. Then after the pre-title sequence, we're going to come back 5 years later. So we always knew that that was going to take a certain amount of running time. So the trick was, how can we cover those bases and honor that part of the story, but how can we get to it quickly?
Did things not change much structurally? Was there room for things to change?
The third act, we did start shuffling things around. We shuffled a lot of scenes with M, Tanner, and Moneypenny and Q. Those sequences were moved around to suit the story.
We were in Matera, Italy, shooting the opening in our wine cellar, we were editing in a wine cellar hotel. We were also coming up to the shoot, which we'd return to at Pinewood, of everything at the island, the final stuff. And so we had to pay attention to the opening because we're shooting it, simultaneously pay attention to what details do we need to make sure we nail it in the third act, which is the most important thing. So kind of we had the two most important things happening at the exact same time. And remember, we sort of took turns going back and forth on nailing what we could of the Matera stuff coming in our wine cellar with 2,000 bottles of wine on the wall, while also writing out scripting, taking care of your script and adding little details about what we thought might accent clarity. That was an interesting time.
Are the really important scenes that appear in the teaser, which are in Matera, Italy. And Carrie wanted us both there on location to help support while they were shooting. But at the same time, both Elliot and I realized that so the important storytelling stuff that's also coming up when we finish this, is a lot of the plot stuff with Heracles and what that means and how that affects people. And so we had to start focusing on cutting those exposition scenes. And those continue to evolve because those scenes were heavy in terms of graphics, visual effects, and monitors. And, you know, those scenes continued, the way we cut them continued to evolve as those graphic elements evolved. We moved a lot of that stuff around.
Elliot, what do you think the advantage of having you two on set? Like, why would you need to be in Italy? What was the value to the director?
It was Matera, Italy. Nowhere looks like Matera, Italy. We had to really get the footage we needed while we were there. And he needed to know that it was working so he could pick up shots immediately, like the next day or later that day. Simultaneously, we're about to shoot the ending of the movie days later. So there's a certain amount of scripting that goes into that. That's part of our job. We may not write the lines, but we help connect the dots so that Carrie can work writing with a writer to express it with, you know, better. And it was really interesting on this film, the beginning and the ending were being connected at the same time.
Did you guys feel like you needed to watch other Bond movies? Did you do anything as a muse?
No, Elliot and I did. We did it separately, but Elliot and I both rewatched all of Daniel Craig's movies. And what we quickly found out, you know, just talking with Carrie or decided was that obviously when you work on a Bond movie, in a sense, want to honor everything that's come before it. But more specifically, we wanted to make sure that we were going to tie up Daniel Craig's arc as James Bond. So we focused specifically on the four films that preceded us. So both Ellie and I asked our assistant editors to get those four films and put them in the Avid. We actually got them to put split tracks in the Avid because in some cases we were temping with previous music and sound effects from previous Bond movies just to get going, just a rough cut. But we definitely looked at Casino Royale, Quantum of Solace, Skyfall, and Spectre, because there was something from all those movies that was interesting and we wanted to work with.
I just think we came in with the respect to the idea that it was the end of Daniel Craig's tenure and that he's been spectacular. He deserves for it to land brilliantly, and so do Barbara and the family who put so much into this. There was a responsibility in a way that was different from other films.
Tell me a little bit about temping. Did you feel like you needed to temp outside of the Bond universe?
It's a dance between sound, music, and picture. Some will say that picture is the only thing that matters and make sure your sound and music matches it, except for the fact that there's this. If you toss a different piece of music on a scene, it might be that you can cut it entirely differently. It might be better. So our exploration went from recent Bond music to, you know, 1960s, 70s Bond music to Hans Zimmer sort of a combination of the two. We were trying to give it a new life. And Carrie was trying to do that via us. So there was a point where we were taking Hans Zimmer music from other movies and combining it with 1960s, 70s, literally having different stems and tracks of different pieces of music on top of each other in the same scenes, old Bond movies and Hans Zimmer current, trying to find something fresh. But that also helped dictate how we cut it.
Without a doubt. And that's something that was very refreshing and challenging with what Carrie wanted musically for this film, because he was allergic to spy genre music. And anything that was kind of conventional or would be considered more traditional or more conventional, Carrie was not interested in. He did not like. He wanted us to think outside of the box. And outside of the box also included, as Elliot pointed out, dabbling in John Barry's original Bond scores from Under Her Majesty's Secret Service. And we used stuff from Thunderball and different tracks from the 60s. It was amazing to kind of be given that license to try things outside of the box. He really was pushing us to not settle for something that was just kind of what you'd expect. And so both Ellie and I would try really crazy things sometimes, you know, things that you wouldn't necessarily think of. And that ended up being our temp, and that informed what Hans ended up doing later. This is something else Ellie and I told the assistants: bring in every single soundtrack from every Bond movie, from every Eon produced Bond movie. And so we had all the soundtracks loaded from Dr. No, you know, on to all of Daniel's movies. And so we would pick and choose from that. And so even though we were thinking outside of the box, like when you're working on a Bond movie, that James Bond theme and those related themes, I mean, that's like owning a Picasso. That's not something you just discard. It's too valuable to do that. Exactly. So a lot of fun is finding a place for the theme.
There's a moment where he becomes 007 again to us, which is after Cuba. And he's been rescued. You haven't seen it yet. Well, there's a sequencing in Cuba. He goes back to London. He opens up his old, what is it, Tom? The garage storage facility.
His lockup. Yeah.
Yeah. And he has an Aston Martin in it. He's got suits, which he hasn't worn to that point. And he's Bond again. So there's a certain amount of, we'll use some Bond theme before that. But that's got to be the place to a certain extent where even musically, Bond. We were very careful about when we used it. But yeah, there were moments where we tempt the movie with 1960s and 70s score. There's moments where we tempt it with Hans Zimmer, you know, Batman. And there's moments where we combine.
The other thing that I think about with Bond movies, gorgeous locations, incredible set design and production.
By the footage we were getting, the way it was shot and the way the sets were designed, we were invited to use those wide shots. So there's plenty of scenes in the film where you really wanted to stay in a wide shot because to feature some amazing set that was designed. And you'll see this all over the movie, but absolutely in the last third of the movie when we get to Safin's lair. It's very reminiscent of Ken Adams' sets in the early Sean Connery movies. But at the same time, Mark Tildesley is so brilliant. He's made these sets his own, you know, so they really feel like they're functional and they really feel like they're new. But there's a little wink to those older films.
Look, and we're here to talk about editing, I suppose, to a certain extent and how we work with Carrie. But the truth is, we get to interact with everybody. That's part of our job and one of the joys of our job. Even production designers, and people don't quite understand that. Mark Tildesley is a genius at production design, if you want to look up his work, and also a joy of a human being to be around. And it does affect editing. The sets affect editing. People don't quite get that. It's not just showing off, right? Like, let's show off what they, you know, created and then go in for performance. It's as though there's a natural connection between the storytelling of the production designer and the storytelling of the editors. There's a connection between each of them, including costume designer. I was on a film where the costume design influenced the music. So when we're talking about Mark Tildesley and his genius, it matters to us.
Absolutely. And when we think of Bond, you have to think of the Bond franchise as one that did extensive world building from the very beginning. This whole spy James Bond milieu did not exist before James Bond, you know? So it's really the world of James Bond. So in terms of building those worlds, we are building a world. We're continuing to maintain this James Bond world. It's a fantasy and a great way for editors to help build that world and help show that fantasy are through these amazing locations and these sets. And whether it's real location like Matera, Italy, or something designed by Mark Tildesley, I mean, those are things that I think Linus and Carrie were inspired by and shot a certain way, and that helped inform us.
Is it just a factor of the directing? Are fight scenes different in a Bond movie than, say, John Wick?
I think it is director dependent. But all that being said, it is editor dependent too. But I think in terms of how I looked at it with stuff that we got, I learned early on and really learned from the supervising stunt coordinator, Olivier, that Daniel Craig really likes to have his fight scenes as visceral and as ferocious as possible. And what that means for how they shoot it is that Daniel doesn't like to do, if he can help it, extended choreography because he feels like it starts to feel choreographed and tired. And so because of the way Daniel likes to give 110% and because of how ferocious he wants to be, they tend to shoot little pieces where Daniel will execute one move or two moves, but be able to execute those moves with the most perfectly and with the most amount of energy and intensity. He is super intense.
Daniel gives 150% in everything he does, period, in this film. And that's the drama scenes, that's the action scenes. He's not giving a performance as James Bond. He's giving a performance as a human being, as James Bond. And our job is essentially to protect that.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for your time. I know you got to go, and I really appreciate you chatting with me.
Steve, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks to Tom and Elliot for their insight into the cutting of the film. Now we turn to their assistant editors, Elise Anderson and Martin Corbett, for their perspective and some of the behind-the-scenes challenges of dealing with a film of this scale and scope.
So I'm Elise Anderson, and I was one of the first assistant editors on No Time to Die.
And my name is Martin Corbett, and yeah, I was the first assistant editor on No Time to Die.
Did you guys both assist a specific editor on the show?
So I was the assistant to Elliot and Martin was the assistant to Tom. Although obviously we became a bit of a foursome and we sort of collaborated together, but specifically we were designated to those editors. So I was Elliot's first assistant and Martin was Tom's first assistant.
Did you prep not knowing who a specific scene was for?
Sometimes, yes. I mean, there was a slight delay in getting dailies, especially at the beginning with location work. So sometimes we wouldn't know, but then we'd find out.
Martin and I started at the very beginning when we did this pre-shoot, this Norway shoot. We started with the editors. The remainder of the editorial team didn't start until the beginning of principal photography. But the beauty of that beginning time, which was, I think it was a week of the shoot, and then we had a couple of weeks with them, it allowed us to really get to know them both and really pinpoint the workflows and just design a little bit. Obviously, as we know, that all can change as you go along and you adapt. It really gave us that time back then to figure out a few of the basics and the bases of how we were going to prep the scene for a daily basis, for example. So even though they did cover different scenes, we sort of had a generic idea of how we were going to prep them. And then when it became clearer which editor was going to do what scene, we would start tailoring them more specifically for that editor.
Let's say you've got a generic bin that you've prepped dailies for, and you know it's Tom Cross. What do you have to do differently than Elliot?
To be honest, we didn't really have to do anything differently. There were just a few instances, but you know, there was a lot of information that went into the bin. So between like having chats with both of them, we would include all, you know, like all the continuity notes, all of that, as much information as we could, we would get into the bin. So for some scenes, it would just need to be organized in a slightly different order. That's all. Just like if there was a lot of action, a lot of the times in the film, second unit would shoot prior to the main unit. So then we'd have all the second unit footage, then we'd have main unit footage, just organizing it into sort of script order, basically. And, you know, that wasn't really sort of editor specific. It was also scene specific. It depended on the amount of footage, the sort of complexity of it, basically.
Both of the editors, you know, they had the same view of, they both liked thumbnail view for their scene bins, and they both liked to have the same notes in them and stuff like that. So from a consistency perspective, that was the overall design of our scene bins for them from the beginning.
And did they both edit directly from the thumbnails, from the takes, in other words, or did they like you to prep like a chem roll or a string out of some sort?
We did a chem roll, and I think Tom edits directly from the chem roll, doesn't he, Martin?
Yeah, Tom would then make his selects from the chem roll. He's got some fancy buttons, like mark is in and out, and then just hit a button and it would basically go and make a roll of that.
Elliot, I believe, used to put his select markers directly on the clips themselves. He would go through and put markers throughout the clips.
I'm assuming that there was a dailies lab of some kind. What did they do, and what was the delivery like from them?
There were a few dailies labs. So obviously we have the 65 mil and then the 35 as well. And when the shoot started off, it was predominantly 65, well, for the Norway shoot. So that was processed by CineLab. And then they would process the 65 millimeter. Then that would then go to Final Frame, who would then produce 2K dailies for us. And then that would then be sent to Company 3, who would then process our dailies. For the, say they started shooting on the Monday in Norway, we got that Thursday/Friday into the editing room. You know, one thing we ended up having to do quite a lot, especially with the 65 mil material, and when they were on location in Jamaica and even Norway, it started, was we'd have to bring in the video assist footage, and then both Tom and Elliot would cut with that and then show carry something, then 2 days later we'd get the footage.
And how did you sync up that footage? Was there some kind of metadata with the tap, or no? Do you have to eye match it?
Yes,
that was a lot of eye matching.
Yeah, so then we'd have to eye match and basically overcut.
On a film as big as No Time to Die, I'm assuming there was a VFX editor.
We had a fabulous VFX editor, or we had a big team, but we had our VFX editors, Billy Campbell and Carlo Melillo, who were on it right from the beginning. Billy especially was actually on it for a couple of months before we started,
yeah,
wasn't he?
Billy started after Christmas, I think, and then we started in March. Because there were a lot of tests with regard to the 65 mil.
And they were pre-vising some of the big stunt-heavy scenes and stuff, so he was then bringing that in from the beginning.
What are the things that you guys need to coordinate with other departments? I know assistants do a lot of coordinating between some of the other departments.
On a daily basis, obviously, it was dealing with production and the shoot. We had a lot of interaction, particularly Martin had a lot of interaction with the production department, and also video assist of getting the video tap and stuff when we were getting all of that. But talking to production every day about where everything was being shipped constantly, especially when we were doing the stuff away. And then and all the stunt heavy stuff, we were liaising a lot with the stunts team and then VFX to get previs and some of the heavy stunt scenes before we were going to shoot them and stuff. So that happened throughout the shoot as well.
You know, because a lot of the shoot was done at Pinewood Studios. You're always having the camera departments, art departments, everybody pops in, you know, and we would pop over to set and we'd pop over to set both with Tom and with Elliot. We would go over and show Carrie cuts.
Before I leave that idea of the VFX editing, I want to get at least from you, like, what do you see in your timeline? Is there timeline management for VFX?
We definitely developed that as we went along. We had a VFX titles layer and a new VFX layer. And as it went along, whenever we got new VFX, they would put on the new VFX layer and the editors would go through and eyeball them and they would drop them down.
You and the VFX editor couldn't drop it down because the editors were approving something and deciding it could be seen?
It was, yeah, it was more so that they had a chance to, even though they probably would have seen it previously in a VFX review, and sometimes that was the case, they would say to us, oh, we said there's new VFX there, and they would say, we've already seen them all in the VFX review yesterday, they're fine, you can drop them down. Or they would want to go through them just to make sure and to see if they wanted to, you know, alter the cut to either side of that shot. I wouldn't say that there were necessarily designated layers for the VFX on our side of things. That just kind of happened in a really organic manner.
Can you tell me what exactly was the size and the compression in Avid that you guys were working at?
We were DNX115 in the Avid. Obviously, the 65 mil, we had the 143 ratio, and then also the 190. And then obviously 35 mil was scope. It was a little bit of to and fro in at the beginning, but then we decided that then we would view the 65 mil and 190, and then the 35 then would be at 240. So the whole opening was shot 65, either 143 or 190. And then as we go into the titles, that's when it opens up to 240 and 35 millimeter.
How did you guys listen to the audio in the edit suites? Was it stereo, LCR, 5.1?
We worked in 5.1. That was a decision based on, I believe Elliot had worked in 5.1 before. I feel a lot of cutting rooms are at the moment steering towards working in 5.1. And Tom was extremely open to doing that as well. So we worked in 5.1 from the beginning.
What kind of creative things did you guys get a chance to do on the film?
Very early on, obviously during the shoots, we both had a lot of sound work to do. I would say at least you'd did more, some more sort of creative cutting work during the shoot.
I think we were definitely doing a lot of sound work for both editors from the beginning. Obviously, you know, the balance between getting dailies done and doing the creative stuff when you're doing the shoot is a fine balance. Tom would hand over a lot of sound work to be done on his scenes, and then Elliot had me doing sound design on his scenes, or it, you know, if I didn't have the time or whatever, I'd pass them along straight to our sound department, who were designing them very early on. And we were also getting a lot of, like I mentioned earlier, the previs and stunt viz for some of the scenes that were to be shot that we were massaging. I had to rework a lot of the previs that would come back, and then we'd have to massage it to the cut and some of the stunt viz that was coming in. It was a lot of back and forth in that sense. But as we got into post-production as well, and we started getting it running down the line of trying temp ADR lines and things like that, that became involve everybody, you know, all of the assistants.
Producers would sometimes come in to watch cuts. I'm assuming that was thoroughly vetted, because the editors are usually very protective of the director. Nothing gets shown to anybody other than Carrie unless it's vetted.
Carrie would always know they were coming over. It was never, they didn't just show up like out of the blue. Carrie was shooting, so they would come.
I think as well, when we were shooting, it wasn't so much to come over to look at cuts and things. They would come over for planning for upcoming shoots and stuff. It would come over to talk to the editors about, because we had so many moving pieces on this film.
What were some of your responsibilities at the end of the film to get stuff off to other departments?
Between Elise and I, we sort of divvied that up. Elise dealt with sound, and then I would deal with picture. And obviously, you know, DI and picture. Obviously, you've got the main title credit sequence in a Bond movie, so I would deal with that. Whereas Elise dealt with the sound and the ADR.
What were some of the things you had to deal with sound that was going out and coming back?
The schedule on this, which is quite funny now in hindsight, but the schedule on this at the time was quite tight. We were all racing to a deadline. So we had the sound department on very early. We did have one temp mix for what was meant to be a friends and family screening that didn't actually come into fruition. We were doing a lot of ADR. The ADR, it became quite an intricate process I was monitoring it daily because there were new ADR lines coming and going, and then liaising with our dialogue editor, Becky Ponting, in regards to that. So that was a constant back and forth. I mean, I was managing that every day towards the end there. And the sound department, I mean, they were only based not far from us, and we were very close with the sound department.
And with the composer, or there was probably a music editor as well, and you were collaborating with the music editor?
Yeah, he was based on the floor with us in Soho in London. So he had a room in our building on our floor. So that Kerry could come down to him if necessary to show him stuff, and vice versa. He could come to the editors very easily and talk to them, which was great.
When compared to the start of shooting, did you guys come on?
We started like 2 weeks before the actual, I think it was two or three weeks before the shoot.
And what were some of your responsibilities? What were you doing in those 2 weeks?
to be honest, just working out, there was lots of calls and meetings about workflow. As we say, Billy Campbell, the VFX editor, had been on since January, and they've been doing tests. And then it's like, well, what cameras are you using? You know, nothing had, I think when we started, nothing had been decided. Then things were getting decided, and it was getting closer and closer. And the reason they shot Norway first is because you will see when you watch the film, the ice was melting. So that's why it was brought forward slightly. So they had to get out there and they had to shoot before the ice melted.
It was a lot of designing the workflow of where the rushes were going to be and how they were going to get to us and in what time frame.
Which was usually...
and who needed to know, we sort of spent those first couple of weeks designing these workflows. It was like, who needs to know, tracking it exactly where it is along the various stops it will be until it gets to us. And setting up the cutting rooms, working with the editors to set them up, those beginning few weeks is so important to editorial, because as soon as the shoot starts, we hit the ground running. So we want to make sure that physically the cutting room is in such a place that everyone's happy, everyone's comfortable. Each room has had the sound calibrated and the lights set up in the exact way they want, and everyone's got a sofa and a desk and all that sort of stuff, so that we're ready to go.
I heard that you brought in the previous movies into the app.
Yeah, that was, I think, something from Tom and Elliot just sort of sitting down and chatting together. They were like, hey, we should bring in the old movies. And then we brought in all the soundtracks as well for every movie, which is sort of a really lovely thing when you look in the projects and then you sort of open that folder and it's like all the soundtracks. We had like this sort of split stems from Daniel Craig's movies, so they could actually use sound effects as well.
I want to thank you so much for chatting with me and giving me some time today. And I am really pleased to talk to both of you. Congratulations on a very impressive project.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We're very excited about it.
Yeah, I hope you enjoy the film when you see it.
That's it for Art of the Cut this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, these interviews are also available to read at blog.frame.io, where they're supported with great visual content, images, video clips, and more. It's a great opportunity to check out the other expert content on the blog for filmmakers of all types. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors, for a topic-driven, curated experience. Thanks to my guests, Tom Cross, ACE, and Elliot Graham, ACE, and their assistant editors, Elise Anderson and Martin Corbett. Thanks to Dylan Giovanetto for editing today's podcast using Adobe Audition. And thanks to Frame.io for their support of Art of the Cut and its pledge to keep this content coming your way. If this is a podcast that you got something out of, follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Steve Hallfish. And so you don't miss out on all the great upcoming interviews on the Art of the Cut podcast, subscribe to this podcast. And remember that if you have a friend in the film business or who aspires to be in the film business, make sure to tell them about the Art of the Cut podcast and blog.frame.io.